Hello everyone and welcome to RadChat, the multi-award-winning first therapeutic radiophallowed oncology podcast. So welcome to a bonus series in paid collaboration with Elekta, who are a global company that provide radiotherapy and radiosurgery treatment solutions for cancer care. My name is Naman Joker Anderson and I'm joined by fellow host Joe McNamara.
Hi everyone!
A big thank you to our last guest, Dr. Matthew Foote, who discussed his career as a radiation oncologist, integration of gamma knife and health inequality. If you hadn't had a chance yet, please do go and take a listen. So we're very pleased to introduce our guests today, Dr. Seth Mbile Ningidi and Dr. Mogawale Motabajane. How are you both?
We're well, thank you.
You're wonderful, and how are you?
Good, thank you for joining us. So Seth Mbile, would you mind just introducing yourself and telling us about your current role?
Okay, so I'm Dr. Mbile Ningidi. I'm a clinical and radiation oncologist here in South Africa, in Johannesburg, in the private sector. I do medical oncology as well as radiation oncology, which I've trained in both.
Can I ask, what made you want to work in oncology?
So it was actually in university when I was an undergrad in the fourth year of medical school. I saw the professor of oncology come to give us a lecture, and I was just so in awe and inspired because he was talking about radiation and chemo, and it just blew me out of this world because it was just so different. And I just wanted to do something different in medicine where I could do a mark. So I saw that in South Africa, we've got quite a small number of medical and radiation oncologists, so I wanted that to be a field where I could make a difference, and that inspired me and has driven me to do all the different techniques that I do in radiation, and I guess the thirst for knowledge and always knowing more in this field.
And Mogwale?
Hello, my name is Mogwale Motabajane. I'm a neurosurgeon and an interventional neuroradiologist. I train at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, which is in the eastern province of South Africa. And then I acquired my fellowship in neurosurgery in 2013. During that time, I developed an interest in management of intracranial vascular lesions. That's why I joined the interventional neuroradiology team in my institution. In 2014 and 2015, we trained together in Durban. And by 2016, I wanted to go and further my training in interventional neuroradiology in the vascular space. I went to Boston in Massachusetts, in Burlington, Lehigh Hospital and Medical Center under the leadership of Professor Insoop Choi, where I stayed between 2016 and 2017. But being a neurosurgeon, when I came back in South Africa, my practice had to revolve around neurosurgery. Even when I was in my fellowship training in Devon, we were exposed to conformal stereotactic radiosurgeries in neurosurgery. And then gamma knife became one of the techniques which have revolutionized how neurosurgery approach, particularly certain deep-seated and maybe inaccessible lesions in the brain. So I carried that along when I moved towards a private healthcare facility, which I studied in 2018 at one of the mediclinics in Johannesburg, Mediclinic Ferreira in Van der Bank Park. Together with Dr. Ngidi, we consider the combination of neurosurgeon and oncologists working together, and that's why both of us are currently treating most of intracranial lesions which are suitable for gamma knife at Ned Campbell Park here in Johannesburg.
Sound like a dream team.
Yeah,
we work synergistically together.
Can I ask, how accessible is treatment in South Africa?
It depends what sector you're in. So our health system is divided into the public sector, which is government funded, and then we've got the private sector, which is funded by private insurance or medical aids. So access is very easy in the private space because people pay a premium every single month to access certain facilities, and you've got a wide range of facilities from different forms of radiation to very high-tech forms of conformal radiation and different surgical procedures as well. We do have some of this technology as well in the private sector, but access does seem to be a bit of a problem, and we've got waiting lists that can extend for months to years for even certain forms of radiation. We've got different machines as well that are able to deliver for, like, for my field in terms of radiation where we could do VMAT, IMRT, stereotactic radiosurgery, and particularly gamma knife. We've got those available in the private sector. In terms of gamma knife, there are two machines in South Africa that we have available. One is in Cape Town and one is in the private sector in Johannesburg. Most of the patients that access these facilities are patients who either fund themselves or private insurance patients. This is basically the only two machines in sub-Saharan Africa, so they are open to access to other patients from other African countries as well. And we've had quite a lot of patients that have come to us seeking these forms of treatments, which we've been able to render very successfully in these units.
When you say medical aid, is that charity funded or how does that work? Sorry.
So basically medical aid is like medical insurance. It's a private schemes, different types of different funded medical insurances that are available on the market. And it just depends on your affordability as well as what type of premium service that you want to receive. And you pay a certain fee every single month and are enrolled into that scheme. And they can get you access into many different forms of treatment in private care and any specialist that you need and any form of treatment as well. Mokhwale, I don't know if you want to add more.
No, definitely. Yeah. Okay, so depending on affordability, it's a little bit skewed. I guess in the UK, you've got national health insurance, which try to cover everyone. But in that situation, for sure, they try to make equitable access to healthcare. But in countries where there are two different health systems, the haves will always have advantage of getting healthcare because they can fund it themselves. Then the have-not who rely on state to fund, then they have to wait. And the state had to also prioritize in terms of delivery of health services. If microsurgery might be offering cheaper option financially for the state to provide service, people will then be recommended to undergo microsurgery, even if stereotactic radiosurgery might be most effective with less morbidity and actually maintaining good quality of life on that person. You look at someone who come with certain lesions which are not fast growing, you can offer stereotactic radiosurgery and then they return back to work the following day or so. But those unfortunate in intracranial lesion, if you have someone who come and have craniotomy, whether it's microsurgical or not, that person cannot return to work the following day. But because funding, if it comes from the state, they have to prioritize where they have to put their money for effective use to cover majority of the people, they wouldn't consider making gamma knife stereotactic radiosurgery available for state patients at the moment. It gives a little bit of inequity of provision of healthcare because the haves will always have benefit of these services while they have not can. But unfortunately, that's the nature of the beast we are facing everywhere in the world.
Stephanie, so what are the inclusion-exclusion criteria for people having this treatment?
Okay, so brain lesions could either be benign, that means non-cancerous, or they could be malignant, which means cancerous. So in the benign lesions, they're mainly structural lesions within the brain, like you could have a schwannoma or a cavernoma or an arteriovenous malformation. We also treat conditions like trigeminal neuralgia. In ophthalmology, you've got uveal melanoma as well. And then in the malignant lesions, so the cancerous lesions, it could either be lesions that had started primarily in the brain, like gliomas, or could be metastatic, so secondaries that have come from another cancer from a different part of the brain that have metastasized to the brain. It's important as well to understand that size is very important. Because we are dealing with radiation as well. So they preferably is a small tumor. The median size, we generally say, is about 3.5 centimeters. You could even stretch it to 4, but generally we like around that range or a bit smaller. The smaller, the better, because you've got a higher dose fall off as well, and your gradient is much steeper as well. And lesions also mustn't be too inferior down in the brain, or close to the craniocervical junction as well. So that's the inclusion criteria. Anything else outside that, we generally don't really include it in the gamma knife. So that's the inclusion criteria.
I'm interested to ask, just because of all the other indications, when we think about stereotactic neurosurgery, we often think about metastatic disease, but I'm learning more from doing this series just how many other indications we can treat using the Gamma Knife. Could that potentially mean that actually you have even more patients who are in need of using the Gamma Knife and not just those oncology patients?
Definitely. And it's also what we have found in our practice as well. It's about educating patients as well as other specialists as well and other doctors to say there are more indications than just a cancer. I mean, for someone who's got, let's say, trigeminal neuralgia, it's such an excruciating and debilitating nerve pain that you could have. And often when it's refractory to medical treatment, patients do get referred to us for treatment. And they've been treated quite successfully with Gamma Knife. I think also the important aspect to understand is that you don't get the results that are instantaneous. It takes weeks to months and quite a long time for you to get results. So I forgot to mention another exclusion criteria is that there mustn't be any life-threatening conditions as well, because you don't get instantaneous results. So there mustn't be anything life-threatening as well. And we've started talking and starting conversations with our colleagues and with patients to say, hey, there's more to this indication and speciality than just a cancerous lesion. So, Hale, I don't know if you've got anything else to add.
Yeah, a clinical indication also have to consider patients' needs rather than what a surgeon or oncologist ought to offer. Speaking from a surgical perspective, lesions which are smaller, which might be accessible, also might be very good lesion for microsurgical cross-total resection. So when we are looking at those lesions, most surgeons tend to say, I can go and take it out, and then why must I subject someone to stereotactic radiosurgery? So just for example, I had someone who had an olfactory group meningioma accessible through microsurgery, but it was on the frontal basal area. This person is a school teacher in whom personality, interaction with patients, memories, and things like that are very quite important for this person. And then to go and do microsurgery and start, although we tend to claim that we do retractless surgery, we are not going to retract the brain limb. But if you were to, by any chance, have any contusion towards the frontal basal area of the brain loop, the memory of this person will be affected, the personality of this person will be affected, and then how he's going to interact with people at school also might change. You might have interfered with this person's career for the rest of her life. So in that situation, I could have opted to say it's accessible, it's easy for me to remove, but I considered those one and I gave patient all options available, and then Gamma Knife was the way to go because it was not a life-threatening disease. It was meningioma. It was a slow-growing, so we could treat it in that manner. So when you look at inclusion criteria, don't only look at the size of the lesion and things like that. Also consider what impact will microsurgery versus conformal stereotactic surgery will have on this person in terms of mobility, no matter how subtle it can be. For a teacher, memory impairment can be career-ending. So while by offering Gamma Knife, I wouldn't have touched the brain and that memory can be spared. And again, the age of a person, subjecting severe elderly person only because you want to do microvascular decompression to manage trigeminal neuralgia, you risk the possibility of that person maybe having lower cranial nerve palsies, that person having to need to tracheostomy and things like that. You have to consider those who want to say, can I go and do microvascular decompression and separate the trigeminal nerve from the atrial vein, or must I subject this person to Gamma Knife? Then definitely it goes to show that you can then say, I stratify my patient, and those who may not tolerate microsurgery, then I'll offer them a Gamma Knife, even if in your hands you are competent to do that surgery. So for me, I always look at those conditions before I decide which one I subject to what.
It's such a good point to personalise the medicine, exactly as you said. Just had a quick question. You said microsurgery. What is that? How would you explain it in a basic way? Because I'm thinking using a lot smaller instruments than a craniotomy.
Yeah, you see, in most cases, neurosurgeons tend to think that if you have small access, which does not have greater skull defect, then that will be microsurgery. Usually they consider if the size of the craniotomy will be 2 cm by 2 cm, to be microsurgery, the others will extend to 3 cm. Previously, we used to do bigger frontotemporal craniotomy to go and clip an aneurysm, and then as the technique were perfected, then you can go through an eyebrow. If you can make an incision through the eyebrow, and then you can close it through the eyebrow, it's microsurgery. Small excision behind the ear, just to go and separate the trigeminal neuralgia, then is considered microsurgery. So as long as it's not that gross, then we thought it is microsurgery, trying to limit defect, because aesthetic is also something important for any person which you are going to operate. Particularly, you can't hide the head. Your head is your passport to society, including your face. So anything you do around the head and the face, you must know that it have long-term effect on this person. So you have a young child also who is a girl, in which aesthetic can definitely affect the self-esteem of this child, and this child have a cavernoma or her brain AVM. Before you go and cut this child's skull and then remove piece of a bone, fix it back, only to remove this brain AVM, which can be treated with gamma knife, consider the impact of that scar on that child. So no matter how good you are with your own surgical techniques, but also consider what your aesthetic look may have impact on this child. Now we know bullying at school, and then if a child has a scar, and then from there you have to go and fix it back with some small plates, and that also will have impact on how other children interact with that child. So I also look at those aspects before I decide. Because, you know, it's not like once you've done microsurgery, and then, I mean, once you've done gamma knife, and then you follow up, and then you realize that the lesion continues to grow, you cannot operate. You still have microsurgery as an armamentarium which you can use. So why don't you offer the less aggressive form if there's no life-threatening disease, with a view that should it not offer an ideal and desirable outcome, then you can now use surgery or microsurgery, however you want to put it.
Oh, you come across as so caring and considerate, and I'm sure for any patients listening, it must be really reassuring to know that, you know, you are thinking beyond just the disease or the indication that you're treating. You're treating that person, and that's just lovely to hear. So thank you for sharing that. I'm really intrigued to learn a little bit about how you two work together, because, you know, it can be really challenging when you have patients and you maybe have a favoured approach, and, you know, collaborating can sometimes be really challenging within the medical professions. How do you two do it? How do you create this amazing team?
I think for us, the most important thing, and it's helped us a lot in the way we interact with each other and with patients, is always thinking about the patient first. Their needs come first. And we practice what's called value-based care. So it's about the value in which a patient retrieves out of that medical service. So it's not about us at all or our skills, but it's about what does the patient need at that particular time to get good outcomes. Because at the end of the day, any care that you render to a patient needs to have good and positive outcomes. Otherwise, why would they subject themselves to getting any form of treatment, be it invasive or non-invasive? And secondly, it's also understanding that we are complementary and synergistic in the way that we work together as a team. I may not know all the answers. I'm not a neurosurgeon at the end of the day. He's not a radiation oncologist. But if the two minds meet, can you imagine how bigger the knowledge pool is compared to just one person? And you know what? Someone may also think of things outside the box or view life differently to the way you think of it. So imagine if the patient can see different facets of a medical condition and also solutions as well, because we're very solution-orientated as well, but it's putting the needs of the patient first.
Okay, and we train from similar, in fact, the same institution, and our leadership during that, they have created a neuro-oncology multidisciplinary team, which we have seen it working well. From my side, and then we discussed this thing much better, and then it helped in how it shaped your perspective in how you can approach things. Because sometimes you might have something which is too big that the tumor which is too big that you might not be able to take it all out without actually increasing mobility. Then you are able to discuss with the oncologist to say, if I were to resect it to such margin, will it be okay for you now to take over from there and irradiate? Then it guides you as to how aggressive will you have to go, what amount of risk will you tolerate, because if there's an alternative care to a certain degree of your operation, then you know that if this tumor is abutting the brainstem or if this tumor is close to critical structure and I cannot completely remove it, it's in the cavernous sinus, but I can remove greater part of it and result with maybe 1 centimeter tumor in the cavernous sinus or elsewhere, then I'll leave it for oncologists to come and treat it. That multidisciplinary team, it helped to shape that. And again, being an interventional neuroradiologist also, I found that we discussed this thing extensively between myself as interventional neuroradiologist and other neurosurgeons when we have other vascular tumors like aneurysms, whether going and clipping this aneurysm or going to coil the aneurysm through interventional neuroradiology route, which one will be more favorable to the patient and so on. So eventually that have taught us to say, working through consensus, it make you complementary and provide synergy. There's no competition in how to treat. And again, when superior argument in which one will offer patients treatment better prevail, it's for the best interest of the patient. Egos, I don't think there are still more egos in practice of medicine. We all consider that even patients now, they are part of therapeutic decision making. We don't make decision for them. We provide them with information, which is no longer a paternalistic way of telling people what we are going to do. We share with them medical information, alternative way of doing things, and we say, what do you think will be suitable for you? Of course, clinically guided, because if they choose something which will put their life at danger, we have to guide them. But they have to know and they have to participate extensively in their family into what therapy they are going to acquire. So by so doing, then it becomes easy to work with another colleague and work with other patients. If you prefer to be individualistic and work in solo, you're more likely to be dictatorial. Even when you deal with patients, you'll want to direct them as to what you need to do and dictate unto them, other than saying, let's have a conversation about your condition.
And it also empowers the patient as well to take responsibility for their health condition, but feel that they are actually part of the team. And to be honest with you, a patient is a very integral part of the medical team. They actually sort of lead us into their diagnosis and their needs and what they want to achieve, as well as their lifestyle and other factors actually are the driving force behind all our decisions and even our specialities as well. So when the patient is part of it, they own the decision, they're able to accept all the different methods as well. And I particularly found in oncology, they tend to be able to manage side effects that are there a whole lot better as well when they own the decision and they are part of the decision making as well.
Intrigued about the pathway in terms of kind of your multidisciplinary team working. How do you logistically coordinate? You know, how long does it take for you to reach a decision? Because you are, you know, ensuring that you've got everyone feeding into your opinions and, you know, your decision making. How long can this take, and how do you manage it? Do you have kind of virtual meetings? Are you face to face around a table? How does it work logistically?
Mostly visual, where we can, because of phone which have access to virtual platforms, then we are able to within secured platform, of course, of we share images together, and then we are able to say, look, this is the case which I had. Mostly the cases, as we know, they'll come from the surgical side, because patients will go there first, and then as a surgeon, then I'll share with them and say, please, this is the condition of the patient, a clinical perspective. These are my reason to think that surgery will be more favorable, but these are my other reason also to say that surgery might also be of not great value for the patient. So then what do we decide on that? So it encourages us to read them a little bit more. Usually it's not a simple knee-jerk reaction. We go and look at all other factors which we've put down, we read around them, and then when evidence support other, then definitely. Because if you speak only through emotions and then you are not supported by literature and then you are not supported by evidence, you tend to argue until the end of time. But if you say, is there any guidance in terms of literature which say there is an alternative to what we are thinking, then we entertain it. So when you argue and then you provide good evidence based on literature that the approach is going to be better, then that's where we go. And it tends to solve a lot of arguments, because arguing for the sake of argument to say in my hands, we don't work on your hands only, we also work on evidence which is available there. So previously when the old profs were there, they would say, the level of evidence is me, I'm the authority, I'm telling you. So now a lot of research has been done. And then if you have level one evidence, which is published recently, and then it favoring these modalities, then definitely it seems to make the argument very smooth. And it's actually not even an argument, it's a discussion there. It becomes very smooth, we tend to reach consensus quicker.
And it also helps as well when you present what your findings are or what your agreement is to the patient to say, I've got this evidence from level one and this is the supporting data, because sometimes patients do ask, okay, where did you get this information from, what data was supported? So you've got backup as well. And we live in a modern world as well where there's medical legal aspects to it. So your evidence, we practice evidence-based medicine, it must be evidence-based, where even if another oncologist in, let's say, America or the UK can have the same case, they'll come to the similar consensus as well. So you can't be a maverick and say, I'm doing this. It must be something that a reasonably sound specialist somewhere else could also arrive to the same conclusion as well.
With over 50 years of real-world Lexell Gamma Knife evidence, Elekta Esprit is breaking the boundaries of radiosurgery through evidence of success in a wide range of neurosurgical and oncological brain indications. You want to know more about Elekta Esprit? Come and visit us at our booth at ASTRO in Glasgow between the 3rd and 7th of May. We look forward to seeing you there.
You mentioned obviously that in sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa has the main Gamma Knife facilities. How do you liaise with other countries then who might be sending referrals to you? Is it through that virtual process where you help with the decision making for that MDT team for where that patient might be coming from?
Fortunately, within Africa, from a neurosurgical perspective, the neurosurgeons have established what we call a Confederation of African Neurosurgeons. So where we meet in Africa, we rotate through different countries once a year as a conference, and then again through presentation of our case studies and then case series in those meetings, also supported by literature or review, we are able now to conscientize other neurosurgeons in other part of Africa that there is these services which are available in South Africa. And then here is evidence across the world on literature review. And again, this is our series which we have evaluated in South Africa over the last 10 years on which we have been offering this service. So then from there are also links which we share among ourselves with an African neurosurgeon, that anyone of us who have certain case of interest, then we can drop them in this kind of a drop box and chat, and then we can discuss among ourselves which better way can we do it. And then neurosurgeons from elsewhere, then they can decide to say, okay, there is Dr. Mutebe Jani in South Africa, then we are going to contact him, and then we are going to request him to facilitate the transfer of the patient to South Africa for this treatment. Then from my side, I immediately share that information with Dr. Stem Bilengidi, and she also get information through other neurosurgeons and ENTs. Then from there, she then starts, we work on motivations together. She write a oncology motivation and write neurosurgical motivation. Then from there, we send it to the funders internationally where this patient come from to say this person will get better service if he's coming through Gamma Knife rather than service through any surgical procedure. Then from there, the patient come here. There is networks which were established in Africa, and we are able to communicate through. They are not as effective as we like them to be, but we also think that we can enhance them.
There's definitely room for growth, especially within radiation oncology where we can interact in the different, you know, because we know that there's a bit of disparity in Africa in terms of radiation oncology with even the type of machines that are available, your Linux, you know, some countries are still in the old days where they use kilovolt machines, and in some areas using Linux, and we've got, I think Kenya now has a CyberKnife as well, we've got Gamma Knife and other, you know, the upper northern countries as well, so there's collaboration. But also what is wonderful is that we're now having meetings where we sit and we meet in a particular country and we talk. And the beautiful thing about technology is that there's telemedicine now. So even if you're unable to travel somewhere, you can log on and have a communication with your colleague elsewhere. Just like this platform as well, we're in all in different parts of the world, in different parts of the country, but we're able to meet because there's a common purpose and a common goal. What we also do is we tend to share the information that we have gathered from the patients as well with the referring surgeon or radiation oncologist from that particular institute in Africa to say, this is what we've done. We share our notes, the treatment plan, the dosimetry, and we see how better we can work together and collaborate as well.
We're going to come towards the end of the episode now. We always like to end our podcast with top tips. You have given a lot throughout, but I was just wondering if you both had some top tips for our listeners to take away.
I think it's encouraging patients to have conversations with their doctors, to look at the different platforms or different ways of treatment. We're no longer in the way we need to do things traditionally. We're more advanced as well, but it's having that conversation and including your patients. For doctors, especially in decision making, the patient has to be central around the decision making and collaboration. I think MDTs are very important, where you've got multidisciplinary management as well. That is very, very important. So that's my biggest takeaway.
From my side, I said to my colleague, previously we used to say because the lesion is too small and because it's not causing problem on you, we'll just observe it and you move on until it starts causing problem on someone. We shouldn't be doing that. If there's an alternative way of treating it, such as Gamma Knife, why don't we treat it early while it's small before it causes problem? Because if we can do so, then you are preventing problems. You have deep-seated livedal meningioma, or you have intracavernous meningioma, or you also have deep-seated cavernoma in the brainstem before it causes lower cranial nerves. Treat it. You can't say it's still 2 centimeters, it's still 1.5 centimeters. I won't treat it. I'll just observe it and see whether it grows or whether it starts causing symptoms. Previously, when only surgery was an option, people said, we know that surgery is going to cause morbidity. Let's not hasten that morbidity by surgery. Let's allow that to be caused by the disease first, then we'll treat the morbidity to prevent further morbidity. Of course, it was logical if someone doesn't have any symptoms and you know that your therapy is going to have some element of symptoms, why hasten the symptoms? But now we have alternative way of treatment of saying, I can treat you with Gamma Knife or any conformal stereotactic radiosurgery, which is not going to give you much morbidity, but will prevent this lesion from growing and might even encourage it to regress. It might even make avoid surgery in the future for the rest of your life. Let's consider that. If people can start looking at that, you'll find that the indication for the use of stereotactic surgery will be widened. And then again, the quality of people's life will be improved. Those who may have been subjected to surgery in the next 5 years might avoid surgery for the rest of their life because the lesion has been shrunken. From Dr. Steng, you will say, if I'm correct, that the isocentric dose and then the toxicity of this radiation tend to be less if you're treating lesions which are too smaller than a bigger lesion. So let's consider that. Let's just not avoid getting to intervene early and say, let's wait for symptoms to happen.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on. I think there's a lot more Joe and I would love to ask you, but thank you very, very much for your time. If you're utilising this podcast for CPD purposes, consider the reflective questions posted along with the links to resources and literature we've discussed. To receive your accredited CPD certificate, please complete the Google form linked with the podcast. So our next guest to feature will be Dr. Arjun Sagal, who we're talking about the use of radiosurgery for brain metastases. We'd like to thank Elekta for this paid collaboration. Make sure you go to www.elekta.com to check out their products and services and make sure to check out all the wonderful social media posts accompanying this series. Thank you all for listening and take care.